Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in, a really unique piece of literary history, Marjane Satrapi's autobiographical graphic novel, Persepolis, the story of a childhood. What's so powerful about this, I think, is how Satrapi makes us see this massive political upheaval in late 70s, 80s Iran, not through, you know, a historian's lens, but through a child's eyes, a child who actually believes she's meant to be the last prophet of the galaxy. How does that specific viewpoint make everything, the revolution, the war, feel so immediate?
That tension is exactly it. You've got this boundless, almost mythic childhood ambition right up against the crushing reality of politics. That's the core of its brilliance, really. So our mission today, I suppose, is to look at Persepolis as this vital piece of historical testimony. We'll explore how Iran's complex history, you know, the Shah's fall, the Islamic Republic, the Iran-Iraq War, isn't just told, but felt. And how the art style, that stark black and white, makes the emotional story so accessible.
Right. It's not just a style choice.
No, definitely not. The book itself, it's a memoir covering Margie's life from age 6 to 14. And using the graphic novel form, it kind of strips away all the geopolitical jargon. It forces you, the listener, to focus right on the human cost. Yeah. That visual simplicity, it really highlights the abrupt shift from her, her initially straightforward world into something much more morally gray.
And her world starts in Tehran, in what you described as an oasis of intellectualism. Her family, the Satrapis, they occupy this incredible, almost contradictory space in society. They got aristocratic roots. Her great-grandfather was actually an emperor, but at the same time, they're staunch leftists, communists even. Her own grandfather was a prince, then jailed as a communist by the Shah's father.
It's a huge paradox.
That duality is just stunning. A family fighting for the working class while, having this background of privilege, does that ever cause tension for them, or were they fully committed?
That's a really good question. They absolutely embodied that paradox of Iranian modernity at the time. The book shows that, yes, they were committed to those ideals, but their home was also a kind of sanctuary. Political debate, books, even parties. That life continued behind closed doors, which definitely set them apart.
And Margie absorbs all of this.
Completely. She's living these two parallel lives almost. At night, she's having these intimate chats with God, who looks quite friendly, bearded, planning her own holy book. But during the day, she's this little political reader, devouring books on dialectical materialism, the Marxist ideas driving the revolution, trying to grasp the poverty and protests happening right outside her window. She has this really strong, innate sense of justice that her secular, educated family actively encouraged.
So when the revolution initially happens, when the Shah is overthrown, it must feel like the ultimate victory for them. Political prisoners are freed. And this is when her first real hero enters her life. Uncle Anoush, her father's brother, he'd been jailed by the Shah, spent 9 years in a Soviet prison even before that.
Yeah, Anoush becomes her absolute idol. He's the embodiment of that noble struggle she's been reading about. His stories just fuel her pride. This is really the peak of her young revolutionary idealism. She finally sees the world, or thinks she sees it, as a place where suffering eventually leads to justice.
But knowing the history, that connection feels so fragile. And the anecdote that really stays with you is their last visit, just before he's executed by the new regime. He gives her that swan, doesn't he? The one he made out of bread in prison.
That bread swan. It's such a powerful image. Fragile, yes, but representing love, creativity, defiance in the absolute bleakest circumstances.
And it's key because, as you said, the euphoria just quickly curdles.
Exactly. The hope for democracy vanishes, replaced almost overnight by the grim reality of the Islamic Republic. It's not gradual, it's sudden and severe. Universities closed, Western culture banned, the veil imposed, their whole world of intellectual freedom is forced underground, violently.
And then comes that first truly shattering blow for Margie, Uncle Anoush's execution. Arrested and killed by the very revolution he fought for, accused of being a Russian spy.
Right. And in that stark black and white visual world of the comic, suddenly there's no simple right or wrong anymore. It's completely erased. This betrayal, this injustice, it's too much for her childhood faith. She literally screams at God to get out of her life. That's a fundamental turning point.
A complete rejection.
It is. She realizes, I think, that tyranny isn't about one specific ideology or leader. It's about absolute unquestioning conformity, whatever the flag.
Was that kind of sudden, deep disillusionment common then?
Yeah.
Among young people from similar backgrounds?
Oh, absolutely. For many secular, educated families who would hope for democracy, the disappointment wasn't just political. It was existential. They'd risk so much only to get a theocracy that immediately started targeting its own idealists.
So after that internal breakdown, you get the external chaos, the Iran-Iraq War, starting in 1980, lasting 8 brutal years. The book portrays the absurdity so well, the regime's hypocrisy preaching martyrdom while the elite seem untouched, and that detail about the plastic keys.
The keys. Painted gold. Given to the poorest boys, promised a shortcut to paradise if they died on the front lines. It's chilling.
It shows the absolute manipulation of faith and poverty.
Exactly. Outsourcing the war to children, essentially. Meanwhile, Margie's parents are taking huge risks, just smuggling in posters, tapes, trying to give her some semblance of normalcy, some connection to the outside world, to independent thought.
And the war doesn't stay distant for her. It comes terrifyingly close. Which leads us to the second really pivotal moment.
Mm-hmm.
The missile strike near her home.
Yes. The direct, visceral trauma of war.
She runs back, finds her street devastated. Her Jewish neighbors, the Babalevis, their building is destroyed. And amidst the rubble, she sees it. Not a body, but Nita's turquoise bracelet. Still attached to, well, still attached to her arm.
That specific, intimate detail, the bracelet, it just silences her. All her earlier bravado about the war vanishes. War is no longer an idea. It's the senseless, brutal death of her friend. It cements that loss of innocence and fuels this quiet, simmering rage, a rage she starts channeling into personal defiance.
And that defiance becomes this teenage rebellion. It's kind of wild to think listening to Iron Maiden could be a political act, but in that context.
It absolutely was. Wearing a denim jacket, Nike sneakers, a Michael Jackson pin, smuggling tapes of Kim Wilde or Iron Maiden, these weren't just fashion choices.
They were dangerous acts of self-expression.
Precisely. Satrapi shows us the biggest battles weren't always on the front lines. They were in teenagers' bedrooms. Every little choice was a refusal to conform, a way of saying, I still exist.
Which inevitably leads her into direct confrontation. The third turning point, being stopped by the guardians of the revolution.
Yes, the morality police. Two women stop her for her decadence. The jacket, the shoes, the pin, and they threatened to take her to the committee.
And we need to be clear, the committee wasn't just a talking to.
No, not at all. It meant interrogation, detention, possibly corporal punishment. It was a terrifyingly real threat.
But Margie doesn't just freeze or argue back defiantly this time.
No, she adapts. She uses strategy. She instantly concocts this tearful, dramatic story about her cruel stepfather waiting to burn her with an iron if she's late.
And it works.
It works. The guardians, maybe expecting political arguments, are caught off guard by this domestic drama and let her go. It's a crucial moment. It shows her shift from that earlier, maybe naive, defiance to a more pragmatic rebellion. She learns that survival sometimes requires cunning, even deception. Bravery isn't always shouting truth. Sometimes it's lying strategically to live and fight another day.
This whole cycle, the trauma, the disillusionment, the constant risk, it all leads to the book's climax, really, and this huge act of parental sacrifice. Her parents make that absolutely heart-wrenching decision to send her, just 14 years old, to Vienna.
Alone. Yeah. They realize that her spirit, her intelligence, the very things they nurtured in her were now dangerous liabilities in Iran. Sending her away was the only way they could see to protect both her life and her integrity.
The airport goodbye scene is just devastating.
It is. And the final anchor she takes with her is her grandmother's advice.
Right. Her grandmother, this amazing figure of strength throughout the book.
The ultimate figure of, I'd say, irreverent strength. She tells Margie, always keep your dignity and be true to yourself. This is the woman, remember, who puts jasmine flowers in her bra every morning. A small, personal ritual of beauty and self-possession, no matter how ugly things get outside.
She's giving Margie this survival kit for exile.
Exactly. Self-respect, dignity. Those are the last things they can't take from you.
And Margie did survive. And that story, her testimony, became Persepolis. Which didn't just tell her story, it really helped legitimize the graphic memoir as a serious way to talk about history and culture. This is where you, the listener, can really see the impact.
That power of simplicity we talked about, the black and white art, it's key to its cultural impact. It did so much to humanize Iran for Western audiences. It countered stereotypes by showing ordinary, secular, intellectual Iranians finding ways to resist, finding humor even like those secret parties, stomping grapes in the bathtub to make illegal wine.
It's such a great reminder that oppression doesn't just erase culture, it forces it into hidden creative channels.
Mm-hmm.
Her core philosophy, then, is really about defiant integrity.
I think that sums it up well. It's not about winning some grand battle, maybe, but about refusing to be broken internally. And Satrapi shows us that humor is a vital tool for survival.
How so?
Because it's a profound act of defiance. It robs oppressors of their power to control you through fear and despair. If you can still laugh, you still have a part of yourself they can't touch.
That's a really powerful take on a truly profound book. Persepolis stands as this incredible testament to how things like intellectual resistance, family connection, humor, they become sanctuaries against political oppression. So let's try to distill this into three key takeaways for you listening.
Okay. First, perhaps, an emotional insight. The real personal cost of big political events is often best grasped through small, fragile symbols. Think of Uncle Anoush's bread swan. It reminds us that huge historical forces always land hardest on individual human lives. Second, an intellectual insight. Critical thinking isn't a luxury, it's a fundamental survival skill. The ability Margie learned from her parents to question authority, to reject simplistic official narratives, that's the ultimate defense against manipulation and tyranny. And finally, a universal insight. Keeping your integrity often comes down to small, everyday acts of defiance. The fight for freedom isn't just in protests. It's fought in our bedrooms, in our music choices, and just insisting on being ourselves each day like the grandmother with her jasmine flowers.
It makes you think. Margie and Satrapi's greatest failure as a child was, of course, her powerlessness against the violence and oppression surrounding her. But maybe her ultimate act of recovery, her ultimate resistance, was transforming that very failure into testimony. She ensured the human cost and her family's defiant spirit wouldn't be forgotten. So a final thought to leave you with. What small act of personal defiance are you holding on to today? What little thing helps keep your own integrity intact in whatever world you navigate? Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.